I don't know exactly when. I read Tom Holland's Dominion. If you've not read it, I commend it to you. Dominion: How the Christian Revolution Remade the World. That was my first introduction to Tom Holland, and that was about the same time, I would guess, that he was kind of coming around to the claims of Christianity, maybe a little bit after. But what is going on with public intellectuals, philosophers like Tom Holland, A.N. Wilson, other names that you would know, even Richard Dawkins is a little bit in the mix, though probably not to the extreme of Tom Holland and A.N. Wilson. There's an excellent piece at Christianity Today that you need to read, ChristianityToday.com. Some of Christianity's biggest skeptics are becoming vocal converts. The author, Dr. Nathan Guy, Associate Professor of Philosophy, Theology, and Ethics, serves as the director of the David E. Smith Healthcare Ethics and Human Dignity Initiative at Harding University. And Dr. Guy, it's an honor to welcome you to the Paul Edwards Program in Detroit.
Well, thank you very much. It's an honor to be with you.
What prompts you to do sort of kind of an in-depth investigation into these public intellectuals who are noted for either their skepticism toward Christianity, their agnosticism toward Christianity, or their outright atheistic worldview? What is it about their stories that piqued your interest?
Well, they're fascinating. You know, 20 years ago, everyone was talking about the new atheists, the four horsemen, you know. But I find these new Christians, and we're using Christians loosely here,
right.
I find that just much more fascinating and intriguing. I always thought the new atheists were great with rhetoric, but they were mostly using well-worn arguments. You know, you'd find much better arguments in Hume. But among these new Christians, you're finding people saying things that, you know, theologians were arguing years ago. And they're saying, you know, this has to be true. And I just find it really interesting.
You make a comparison to these vocal converts, as the headline characterizes them. You kind of make the point that this has a precedent in history. In the 60s, Christianity Today had, way back then, 50 years ago, had an editorial under the heading "The New Christians." What was going on in the 60s that is a corollary to what's happening with these new Christians?
So that was an editorial in July of 1971, and it was just called "The New Christians." There was no author's name attached, so I'm assuming that was Carl Henry. And they were focusing on what they called an offbeat group that was known as the Jesus Movement at the time. And they were describing them, and they were trying to give positives and negatives, and they said on the negative side, a lot of people are saying that they're super subjective, that they have a faith that is focused more on their feelings or their emotions, and that, you know, an objection was that faith requires cognitive knowledge. And I think it's interesting, you know, fast forward 50 years, and we've got an equally offbeat group, call them intellectual Christian-ish, these people who are saying, well, I'm either not fully Christian or I'm very new to the Christian faith, but I'll tell you what drives me there are these very important intellectual questions that I can't find firm ground for anywhere outside of a Judeo-Christian historic framework.
You know, I'm really interested in Tom Holland for the reason I mentioned at the beginning introducing you. My first introduction to Tom Holland was Dominion. I then started listening to his podcast, which I don't understand why these guys have to have two-hour-long podcasts, because who has that much time? But then I say that I'm sitting here with a three-hour radio program, so those that live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. I'm just saying, Tom Holland had a reputation as an intellectual skeptic. I wouldn't think that he would be an outright atheist. Maybe so, but maybe you've got the backstory a bit on Tom Holland. But his book Dominion really makes the case for the influence, the cultural influence on Christianity, that the world would not be what it is, especially in the West, without Christianity. Who is Tom Holland, and what's significant about him?
Okay, so Tom Holland is a very popular historian and a British guy. And before that book came out, you know, back in 2016, he wrote an article in the New Statesman. And the title of the article was "Why I Was Wrong About Christianity." And I'll tell you a little bit about that, but if you follow his work, every year he seems more and more to follow the line of, well, if this is true, then what else must also be true? And way back then he was saying, you know, I've been researching ancient Greece and Rome, and I'm reading about these Caesars, and I'm reading about these generals, and there just isn't this deep sense that human life is sacred, that people matter, that equality is a value to hold, you know, very high. And yet, here I am, in the modern world, thinking that the UN Declaration of 1948 is right, that we believe every person is born into the world free and equal in dignity and rights. Where did I get that idea from? Where do we all get that idea from? And why do I think that equality matters? I think liberty matters, freedom matters, people matter. Well, and he says, it just drove me back to realize that I am living off of this Judeo-Christian worldview that permeates our culture, probably permeated his childhood. And he says, I just keep coming back to that. So he'll use language in some podcasts, and he'll say, I am Christian. And I think by that he means my worldview, my ethics, my view of humanity as full of dignity have been shaped by the Christian story. And he's not wrong about that.
Dr. Nathan Guy is my guest, Associate Professor of Philosophy, Theology, and Ethics, serves as the Director of the David E. Smith Healthcare Ethics and Human Dignity Initiative at Harding University. We'll ask him about that in just a moment. The idea of cultural Christianity, before we get into some of the other names that you you explore here in your Christianity Today piece, the idea of cultural Christianity seems to play, and I'm not interested in having a conversation about Christian nationalism, but there are a lot of people that will wear the label Christian or wear the label evangelical. Mark David Hall, in his book, Who's Afraid of Christian Nationalism, actually did a dive down into the stats to determine that upwards of 55% of those who call themselves Christian or evangelical don't even subscribe to the bare minimums of what it means to be a Christian in terms of identifying Jesus Christ as the divine Son of God, faith in Jesus Christ alone being necessary for salvation. Most of the, probably maybe all, and you can clarify this for us, Dr. Guy, the most of these public intellectuals who seem to have rediscovered Christianity or come around to Christianity, would you say that's kind of the Christianity that they're coming around to, more of what Dawkins calls a cultural Christianity rather than what we as evangelical Christians would understand as a biblical understanding, a theological understanding of Jesus as the divine, eternal, co-equal, co-eternal Son of God and faith in him alone. This isn't really faith as much as it is intellectual assent to almost a utilitarian view of Christianity.
Well, I appreciate that critique, and it's worth noting. And so you're asking me if that's what this is, and I'd say it depends. You know, I am a conservative Orthodox Christian, which in most of Christian history would just be called Christian, you know.
Yeah.
Just, that's the language.
Right.
But the language for compared to where we are today. And so, of course, I mean, you know, the Apostles' Creed lays out what Christians do and ought to believe. But the example I like to use is, you know, in Jesus's day, there were a number of people who only knew one thing about him. I mean, think about the blind man in John 9. He knew one thing about him. I once was blind, and now I see. And that was enough to say something meaningful, so meaningful that it, you know, gets a whole chapter in the Bible. Think of all these people who were healed by Christ, and then the next time Christ shows up, there's a throng of people waiting to hear more about him. And so I look at this and I say, these people are coming around to something important and something true. Historically, philosophically, the arguments about who God is, how to define God, have included statements like, you know, truth, beauty, and goodness are just other names for God. And so if someone catches on to truth or catches on to beauty or catches on to goodness, I believe they're catching on to God. And it's fair, I think, to have a generous read and say, these are people who are doing good, bringing good, speaking good. You might even say they're not far from the kingdom of God if, in fact, they're getting closer and closer. You know, you have to get that great language in Scripture about, you know, those who feel after him. Think of the Paul speech in Acts 17. It's a very generous approach, and that's the way I want to approach them.
Yeah, I concur completely. There are those in the Christian culture, in the Christian community, and let's just narrow it down to the people in this audience. There is a segment of this audience, I mean, you're talking largely to conservative evangelical Christians with a smattering of Catholic Christians here in southeastern Michigan, the Detroit area. And when we hear, and I include myself, when we hear about a noted personality or a celebrity or a public intellectual in the context of what we're talking about here today, Dr. Guy, we get very excited about the potential for the advance of the gospel because somebody well-known, somebody popular, somebody that's got a name, somebody that's got a platform is now advancing. This isn't what we're talking about. They're not advancing the cause of the gospel per se, but they are basically giving an endorsement for at least a utilitarian value to the Christian worldview. What should be our perspective on, and I want to explore A.N. Wilson and others that you talk about here, but what should be our perspective on this? What you have pointed out about, here you've got these public intellectuals, public philosophers, previous critics of Christianity, now coming around to supporting Christianity. Should we say, boy, this is great for Christianity, and simply be excited because somebody with a well-known name is now advancing, quote unquote, the cause of Christianity?
Well, my personal proclivity is yes, we should be excited, but I want to appreciate the critique, and I don't mean excited because I give into something like celebrity Christianity. I don't mean it that way.
Sure, right.
What I mean is something closer to what Paul meant when he's in prison and he says, listen, people are preaching Christ for all kinds of reasons, and I'm just grateful that his name is getting out there. And what I'm seeing are people who, take Acts 17, who may not have the language for what it is that they're pointing at. They might not even realize who they're pointing at. But they're pointing towards truth, beauty, and goodness, and we know that they're pointing towards God. And so I see that is something beautiful. And, you know, you mentioned A.N. Wilson. He goes a step further. He starts with the Judeo-Christian stuff, but then he says, you know, this is deeply Christian and profoundly Christian when you start thinking about the foundations for all this stuff that we think is important when it comes to human liberty and equality and goodness. And so I think we shouldn't shortchange people who haven't come as far down the road as the rest of us. I think it's a basic Christian virtue to appreciate where people are. Even Luke in the New Testament has a phrase, you see it in the book of Acts, people that aren't Christian, but they're not pagan. And he calls them God-fearers. It's a really interesting phrase, right? Appreciating people where they are. And I don't know the right language yet. Christian may be too strong of a word, but they're Christian-ish, and I appreciate that.
When we continue after the break, Dr. Guy, I want to explore with you the implications for the trickle-down effect of this, because these public intellectuals, some of them are professors. They have influence on philosophy students, and I wonder what your perspective is on the trickle-down effect of not only these prominent names that you explore in your Christianity Today article, but there are others undoubtedly in institutions of higher learning, in positions of professorships, teaching the next generation of philosophers and scientists. And I wonder what your view is on the the trickle-down effects of that on the next generation. We're continuing our conversation in a minute with Dr. Nathan Guy, Associate Professor of Philosophy, Theology, and Ethics, and the Director of the David E. Smith Healthcare Ethics and Human Dignity Initiative at Harding University. NathanGuy.com is his website, NathanGuy.com, and we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Guy when the Paul Edwards Program continues Recovering the Christian Mind here on WMUZ. There are some prominent public intellectuals that have made a turn toward Christianity. We're not suggesting that they have come to faith in Christ in a, you know, a Billy Graham, the buses will wait kind of way, but they have certainly begun to see, at a minimum, the utilitarian value of Christianity. Tom Holland goes really far by saying that the Western civilization wouldn't be Western civilization without Christianity, and these public intellectuals hold positions of influences in places of higher learning, in media, this excellent piece on Christianity Today is kind of unpacking all of that. Some of Christianity's biggest skeptics are becoming vocal converts. The author, Dr. Nathan Guy, is our guest. So the trickle-down effect, what is the trickle-down effect? What are the generational implications of having these philosophers, and most, I would guess, most philosophy departments in secular universities would be almost atheistic, if not outright atheistic. So, Dr. Guy, what are the implications for the future with philosophy professors who are presenting a fair and balanced view of Christianity to their students?
Well, I can tell you that things have changed for the better, and I'll give you a little bit of background on that. Somebody once said that philosophy leads theology around by the nose, and I think that's true. You know, all these stories that I quote are from the last 15 years, but the fruit, this is all fruit of roots that were laid, you know, 75 years ago. Back then, you really couldn't find a Christian in a philosophy department at any of the Ivy League schools, but now there are Christians as heads of those departments. Mm. And so, you know, what happened is the big question. And I think, you know, late 1800s, early 1900s, what you had being taught in all these programs is, you know, God's dead, the problem of evil proves it, religion's a tool for repression and oppression, and really humanism can provide the ground you need to live a moral life, live and let live and then watch what happens. And I think, you know, we did. We saw what happened. The 20th century was the bloodiest century in the history of the world. After two world wars, I think we had enough. And so the UN Declaration of Human Rights comes out in 1948 saying we believe every person is born in freedom and dignity and equality. And you get the baby boom in the 50s. And, of course, you know, there were heavyweights doing due diligence. I mean, think about C.S. Lewis, you know, Basil Mitchell, Tolkien in his own way. But when you get to the 60s and the 70s, you get this extreme individualism, you get sexual license, social liberation, and you have you expect a backlash to come, and it does. There are people studying philosophy with a deep Christian commitment, studying at the feet of people who do not have that, and just knocking it out of the park, doing such good work that their work rises to the highest levels, and then they become professors, and they become chairs of departments. Alvin Plantinga comes to mind. I mean, he wrote the free will defense for theism that I think put the final nail in the coffin on the intellectual side of the problem of evil. Now, the emotional problem of evil, of course, continues. But if you were to ask philosophers, is there any true contradiction between there being an all-knowing, all-loving God and there being evil in the world, he's the guy who explained how there's not a necessary contradiction there. Alvin Plantinga, Richard Swinburne at Oxford, you know, he writes this amazing trilogy. He becomes chair of the department. People begin to study under him, and he helps pick, you know, other professors. And that leads to a whole second wave. Some names that come to my mind are Eleanor Stump at SLU, Janet Soskiss at Cambridge. You got William Lane Craig and the work that he's been able to accomplish with A Reasonable Faith. When Swinburne stepped down, the guy that followed him at Oxford was Brian Lefthouse, an evangelical Christian. So, I mean, to quote Hebrews, time would fail me, you know, to name all these people. And even those who didn't go into academic chairs, think Francis Schaeffer. There were people who began to write, and their writing made a difference, and people began to listen. And so in 1980, Time magazine ran a story and said, there seems to be a quiet coup taking place in philosophy departments in the academy. And they were right.
I in a previous radio life, I've been on radio in one iteration or another for 23 years here in the Detroit area, almost 12 years from 01 until 2013, and then took a 12-year hiatus to plant a church, and now back just in the last couple of months here. But one of the previous iterations of my radio life, early in the 2000s, frequently Christopher Hitchens would come on my program. He and I developed, I felt like we had a good rapport and a good relationship with one another. But Christopher Hitchens never would have come to a place of say where a Richard Dawkins is in terms of even uttering the words, I'm a cultural Christian. Dawkins once told me that my being a volunteer slave, because I had told him, I said, I'm a volunteer slave of the Lord Jesus Christ, and he, with his British accent, and I could tell, we're on radio, but radio is a great visual medium. I can see him with a bourbon glass in his hand, sipping it, and saying, you make me want to go bathe. It disgusted him, the very idea of being a slave of Jesus Christ. What do you think the difference between a Dawkins and a Hitchens is? Both noted atheists, but Dawkins willing to at least say, I'm a cultural Christian.
Well, I think we're talking about trying to reach the ultimate conclusion to where our argument goes. I've always appreciated, in general, I've always appreciated intellectual atheists who I had the privilege to study under. They were often just refreshingly honest. The one I never got a chance to meet, died before my time, was Bertrand Russell, who said in a speech, he said, listen, since there is no God, there is no real objective meaning. If there's no objective meaning, everything's going to die in a big fiery conclusion, and that includes all the heroism, all those stories. So really, if you want to know what matters, we need to build our hope on the firm foundation of unyielding despair. Well, what he's trying to say is that's the conclusion. Mm. Of course that's the conclusion, if this is all true. And so I appreciate when people try to follow the argument to its ultimate conclusion. And what I think is happening to some of these is they're saying, I can't shake the fact that there are some foundational truths. I believe them to be true. I think the culture believes them to be true. And I think we ought to believe them to be true. But why ought I to tell you that you ought to do something, and that ought is something that everybody should do? You know, that's a really interesting conundrum. It's a puzzle. Why are there some values that trump other values, and that you ought to follow them too in this kind of world? And so what I'm finding in all these people, whether it be A.N. Wilson or Tom Holland or Ayaan Hirsi Ali at Stanford, they seem to be appealing to portions of what we used to call the moral argument, you know, for God's existence. And what they're appealing to is, look, we believe that there's something foundationally important about humanity. We believe in equality. We believe in liberty. We believe in freedom. We believe people matter. But why is that? You know, Peter Singer, very famous non-believer philosopher, said, that's a great question. Why do people matter? The truth is, when we talk about equality and human exceptionality, we're just making that stuff up. The truth is, we can include anybody we want to in the moral community of equals, and exclude whoever we want to. And so, he was just trying to follow the argument to its logical conclusion. And I don't want to go too far afield from your question, but I found it interesting in my own studies. I found that John Locke, who was a Christian philosopher, agrees with Singer's point that this is all just language we're making up if we just go with kind of what we see on the ground. But he adds a little caveat. Unless there is a God who made us in his image, unless there is, in fact, someone who has designed us with a sense of equality and liberty, then and only then can we really make that argument. And that's why Louis Poyman, who died several years ago, but he's the guy who wrote all the standard textbooks on philosophy for Oxford University Press, Louis Poyman in 1991 said, "We're living off the fumes of a religious metaphysic." We believe this stuff because it's what Christianity has infused into our culture.
We've only got a few minutes left. I want to give you an opportunity to tell us about the David E. Smith Healthcare Ethics and Human Dignity Initiative at Harding. Harding.edu, I think, is the website, Harding University. What is your work there, and what do you find most passionate about what you do as director of the Smith Healthcare Ethics and Human Dignity Initiative at Harding?
Thank you so much for that. So I started Harding in 2006, and I went away for a few years, but I've been there most of that time since then, and love it. You know, Harding's 100 years old. We just celebrated our centennial celebration. Students from over 60 countries and virtually all states in the U.S. And Harding is nationally ranked. It's got all kinds of great things, a lot of reasons why you should look into it. And we just started the Healthcare Ethics and Human Dignity Initiative. David E. Smith is the man who helped support that. And what we're trying to do is to infuse a robust understanding of Christian ethics in every discipline, in every department, across campus, in all of our 100 undergraduate majors, and all of our 40 graduate programs. What does it look like to graduate from Harding and to understand the basis of Christian ethics, how it applies to issues involving healthcare, involving AI technology, involving all the stuff that's about to come down the pike? How do we apply that? And then, of course, just in our everyday life, all of us are going to have to ask the question, you know, do I pull the plug, when grandma's now comatose, what do I do with that? There's 100 important ethical questions that come up in everyday life. We want every student to be prepared to deal with that. And I think, I love that the name includes human dignity, because we want to be a trusted presence that has real value for every human life, regardless of background, regardless of position, regardless of religious background. We want everyone to know. We want to do what's in the best interest of believing that human life is sacred. And I'm grateful to be part of it.
Yeah, so I'm assuming that that your initiative there at Harding would speak into the moral issues relative to abortion and relative to end-of-life issues. I mean, you mentioned end-of-life issues. Even as we've just spent the last 30 minutes or so, Dr. Guy, talking about these very public philosophers, intellectuals, coming around to a Christian worldview, understanding at least that the influence of the Christian worldview would certainly leave, without it, would leave a vacuum in our ethics, in our morals. How does what you're doing there at Harding with the Healthcare Ethics and Human Dignity Initiative bring everyday people like me and the listeners to this audience? How is what you're doing helpful to our own understanding of a Christian worldview as it relates to ethics, morals, when it comes to these life issues?
I really appreciate that. And yes, we're going to try to cover the full gamut. So beginning of life, end of life, quality of life, you know, all those kinds of questions are part of what we're trying to deal with. And so a couple of ways we can be of help to you. One is we're going to have speakers on campus every year. We're planning to have at least two major events every year. Our first one, in fact, is coming up October 21. Dr. Scott Ray from Biola University is going to be speaking to us on making moral choices, and he's written textbooks on personhood, one of the issues you were talking about. In the spring, Christopher Tollefson from South Carolina is going to be speaking to us. We've got several other names, notable ones coming up in the future after that. But so those are things you can come to, come be a part of, and I'd love for you to come. It's free to the public. Come and listen and be part of that. We're also going to try to produce some literature, some material. We would love to get that out to the public, even if it's just, you know, trifold brochures on, have you thought about the ethical questions here, the ethical implications of these issues as they come up? And so we really want to be a central hub and resource for the South and throughout the country. And I'm very excited about the work as we're just getting started.
Is there an easy way to get to... I know harding.edu is the main address, but is there an easy way to get to the healthcare initiative for more information about what you've just talked about Scott Ray coming?
We're still working on a much easier web domain name, but for now, Google is very helpful here. If you just type in bioethics Harding, you'll find us, or Healthcare Ethics Harding, you'll find us, and it will take you there. There's a page on Harding's website. We're housed under the Bible Department, but if you take a look at anything on Google, just type that stuff in. Put my name, you can put Harding, you can put bioethics, healthcare ethics, human dignity. It should take you right to us.
Yeah, it did. I just did it. Bioethics Harding, and it came right up.
There we are.
I want to encourage our audience to do that. Go to Google and type in bioethics Harding, and it'll take you to the David E. Smith Healthcare Ethics and Human Dignity Initiative page at Harding University, and you can get the details about Dr. Scott Ray coming and speaking on October 21st. Dr. Nathan Guy is the director of this initiative at Harding and the author of this piece that we've been discussing. At Christianity Today, some of Christianity's biggest skeptics are becoming vocal conservatives. Let me encourage you to go to Christianity Today. You'll find the piece, at least as of 4 o'clock this afternoon. The piece was still linked on the ChristianityToday.com homepage. If not, just search Nathan Guy, G-U-Y, as you might expect, and you'll find the piece, and I commend it to you. And you can also find Dr. Guy at his personal page, website, NathanGuy.com. Dr. Guy, this has been a fascinating discussion. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm sure our audience has as well. And I hope that you'll make yourself available to us down the road as issues warrant.
Thank you, Paul. I enjoyed this. Anytime.
The Paul Edwards Program continues here on WMUZ. You can email me, pedwards@crawfordmediagroup.net, pedwards@crawfordmediagroup.net.